So now we'll go ahead and start on the book of Micah. So because of Micah being a longer book, then it'll take two studies to get through it. So the first thing we're going to look at tonight is Micah and his fellow prophets. It's interesting as you think about Micah and his fellow prophets, you kind of think it's one prophet at a time. But that's not always how it worked, as we'll see with the guys that were prophesying in Micah's time. Micah is one of five Jewish prophets who lived within 25 miles of Jerusalem. So the prophets that God was using at the time were all living in the vicinity of Jerusalem. Isaiah and Ezekiel both lived in Jerusalem. Ezekiel lived in Jerusalem until he was taken into captivity. In his early life, he lived there, and then he was taken to Babylon. And the next thing you know, he's prophesying from the river on the banks of the river Kibar. Jeremiah was only 3 miles north of Jerusalem. He lived in the town of Anatoth, which is a town that had a lot of people that served in the Levitical priesthood. Amos lived, it was a herdsman of Tekoa, which is out in the wilderness about 10 miles due south of Jerusalem. Micah is the outlier. He lived 25 miles outside of Jerusalem. And so he's the one that lived the furthest out. And so all of these men, except Micah, lived virtually inside an area that was relatively confined. And all of them lived with, if you went out from the center of Jerusalem, 25 miles in either direction, you would have the circle in which you would find all of these prophets. Micah was one of three prophets who were all working at the same time. You can figure this out by looking at three different scriptures. I will just mention them, and you can turn to them when you have time. If you look at Hosea chapter 1, verse 1, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, and Micah 1, verse 1, then you see you can pretty much date when each of these men prophesied. For instance, Hosea 1:1 says that Hosea prophesied in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the king of Israel. And you have him prophesying during the reign of four Jewish kings and the Jeroboam, the king of Israel. And Isaiah 1:1 says, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah. So he was prophesying around the same time as Hosea, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So there was an overlap in Jeremiah prophesying. He overlapped with Hosea. And then finally, Micah, the word of the Lord that came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So Micah started later than Hosea because he's not prophesying in the time of Uzziah. He starts in the time of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So there was some distance in time between the prophecies of Micah and Hosea and Jeremiah. As I said, it's easy to think of the prophets, each one coming after the other, but that's not the way it was. As we see from the example here, these men were all prophesying at the same time. Another example of three prophets prophesying at the same time, you have Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Among Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, they mentioned the others. So they knew that the other men were prophesying at the same time they were. So they at times reference each other in their prophecies. as you look at Micah's audience, who was Micah's message to? Micah began to prophesy about the punishment of Israel and Judah about 15 years before Israel went into captivity to Assyria. So the message that Micah had for Israel was quite urgent. And so he prophesied, 15 years before Israel fell, would put it around 705. And in set by 721, 718, 7 through 721, the nation of Israel fell. Judah fell in 586, and so they had a longer period of time between Israel's fall and Judah's fall. And interestingly, Micah was warning them both. And so Micah's telling Israel that, look, things are dire. And if you don't change your behavior, then the nation is going to fall very soon. Whereas there was a time for Judah to repent, time for Judah to make the changes. And as we'll see, God offered them, if they would repent, that he would not bring about their fall. But unfortunately, in both cases, neither one of them heeded the prophet. Jeremiah comes along 100 years after Micah, interestingly. So there's quite a bit of time between the two of them. And as you look at Jeremiah, it's interesting what he says in Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah comes along 100 years later, but what he says to them is the same. The situation is that what Jeremiah has to say almost 100 years after Micah began prophesying is that, and their messages are similar, as we'll see. Now, let's just look at Jeremiah chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. And this is God's instruction to go to the nation of Judah and prophesy to them. And not only does he prophesy to Judah, but you also see him addressing Israel as well. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 1. God tells Jeremiah to go stand in the gate of the Lord's house. So he gave him a specific place to go in order to prophesy to the people of Judah. You know, the people went up to worship in the temple, and so that was a place he could easily access a lot of people that were coming into the temple and going out from the temple. And God says, proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all you of Judah who enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, God, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Do not trust in these lying words, saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. So the nation of Judah believed that because they had God's temple in their midst, that they had a special standing with God, and God would not allow the land to fall because the temple was there. He certainly would not allow the temple to be demolished or desecrated in any way through an invasion. Chapter 7, verse 5, God says, if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between man and his neighbor, interestingly, what New Testament principle is he talking about? He's talking about do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And they were not doing this in Judah. But if they would turn to keeping the second great commandment, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, then it would put them in a favorable light with God. And God would consider not allowing them to go into captivity. It says, if you do not oppress the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place or walk after other gods to your hurt, then I will cause you to dwell in this place in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. So God offered them a way out. He said, if you will repent, then there will be something positive that will come about, and I will allow you to live in the land. And he continues to point out problems in the land. He says, behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you do not know, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name? Say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. So is God going to allow them to continue in this path of sin? And so the point is, God saying, look, you may show up at the temple, you may worship me, but your behavior does not fit with your honoring me and your honoring your fellow man and treating them properly. In verse 11, it says, has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of thieves in your eyes? So God notices their behavior, their mistreatment of their fellow man. And basically, like in the time of Jesus Christ, the temple had become a den of thieves, where they were taking advantage of their fellow Jews as they came up to the temple and giving them sacrifices that were flawed and selling them things that at a high price, and they were making a fortune off of the people who came up to the temple. So there's all this inappropriate behavior. This is not godly behavior, and yet they continue in it, continue to worship God while not practicing what God has instructed them to do. And this had been a behavior that had happened in the past, because God reminds them, beginning in verse 12, about Shiloh. That's where the tabernacle was set up originally. But they went to war with the Philistines, and what happened? The Philistines defeated Israel. You know, they brought up the Ark of the Covenant. They went to war with the Philistines, and the Philistines defeated them. And as a result of that, the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. And that caused all kinds of problems for the Philistines. But this came about as a result of God not favoring Israel and allowing them to lose in the battle against the Philistines. And they lost something that was precious to them in a religious sense. And God said, look, I allowed my tabernacle to be captured, and carried away by the Philistines at the Ark of the Covenant. So do you think that I'm going to spare you because the temple is in your midst? He's saying, you guys are fooling yourselves. People tell you this, but they're not telling you the truth. So what needs to happen is you need to change your behavior. You need to change the way that you are living your lives and the way you're honoring me, and you're not treating your fellow man properly. You change those things, and then I will make sure you dwell in the land. So the challenge was this, that the nation was not living in a way that was pleasing to God. And they were not, God said, I selected prophets, I sent them to you early, I sent them to you repeatedly, trying to get your attention, trying to get you to listen and turn from your evil ways, but you didn't listen. You persecuted the prophets, and you still aren't listening. You guys just don't get it. So God told them, I've sent you these truths, but you're not willing to heed them. And as you look at our nation, you know, we don't have prophets out on the street preaching. We don't have the temple in our midst. But, you know, the Bible has been the book that's been the source of our prosperity. It's been foundational to it. But we've rejected that, and we're going a completely different way. And as a result of that, God notices what's going on. And we live in a very dangerous time because of that. Is God going to favor us? Is God going to bless us? If we have problems ahead of us, we shouldn't be surprised because of the behavior of this nation. Going on, as Israel was coming to an end as a nation, God had Isaiah prophesying. And when you read Isaiah, you don't have you know, we can see that he's giving them the same message that Micah was giving to the people of Judah. They're similar messages both to Judah and to Israel, and Micah was conveying that message, and it was the same message that was given 100 years later by Jeremiah. So you have the prophets giving a consistent message from God, because the human beings involved were sadly succumbing to many of the same sins. And so the message was able to impact each of the nations that God sent his prophets to. As you think about Micah, as we start into that this evening, we're going to take a look in the beginning of looking at Micah and use it as a tutorial for properly reading any of the prophets. So if you understand the things that I'm going to point out next, then you'll be able to get some better understanding of all the prophets, because God is coming at them in a similar direction. So if we understand what God is saying to Micah, then we can apply it to, if we read through Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel or any of the prophets. So first of all, Micah, like every prophetic book, is written to the people of his time period. Micah wrote to the people of his time, and he wrote in a way that the people could understand. So he used information and language that would ring true with them. And that's what we have the same with Isaiah. We have the same with Jeremiah. They spoke to the people of those nations, and they used language that would register with them, that would really help them comprehend the message that God was trying to get across to them. So as you look at their prophecies, they use language that would reflect the social habits of their time, language that would reflect the geography of their time, language that would reflect their understanding of the Bible in their particular time. And so that's something that was commonly done. So they could very clearly understand whatever Micah was saying to them, or Isaiah was saying to them, or that any of the other prophets were saying, because they spoke in a language that they all understood. Now, whether they heeded it or not, that's a different story. They could understand it, though. So to add another point, as you look at the language of the time, they used the language that would be understood by the people of Israel, the common speech of that particular nation. And we know, and we can read what was written to them or spoke, you know, that's a recording of what was spoken to them. And sometimes it's very hard for us to understand, because it reflects the language of the time, and it's been translated into English in our day. And so we're limited in what we can understand. We can get the gist of it, but we can't understand every detail. And we'll get to that, and I'll make that clear here shortly. Consider just the very fact of English. Think about English. You know, we speak a form of English in the United States, American English. But if you go to England, it's very different. Scotland's different. Ireland is different. They speak a form of English, but it's different. And you can go to Australia or South Africa. They all speak English. You can go to Belize and they speak English there. But each has their own aspects to it that make it hard sometimes for us to understand. And so there are things that would be clear to them that we don't understand. And, you know, if you listen to British TV at all, they'll use language that, okay, I know that's English, and I picked up a few words there, but there are some other words that are a little bit different. And so that's something you have to realize as you're thinking about, yes, it's written in Hebrew, but you had the Hebrew that was common in the nation of Israel, and they separated from the southern kingdom. And so there began to be a variance in language between the two nations. They could still understand each other, but you develop certain dialects that were common in one part of the country and another. When we study the prophets, we look for things that transcend time, place, and linguistic barriers. We look for things that we can understand. We may not understand everything, but we can get enough of the message that we can understand what God was having Micah tell them. We try to avoid getting bogged down in the meaning of obscure comments and details, which we can do. We can try to understand them, but we have to realize that some of it we aren't going to understand. And so to bog down in all the minutiae, we have to be careful with that and try to get the big pictures, understand what we can understand, and realize some of it we're not going to be able to understand. And what I'm going to read next is going to illustrate that very point. If you look at, for example, if you look at Micah chapter 1, and we'll look at verses 10 through 16. So Micah's giving this message to his audience, and he's speaking of a subject here, and you'll see what I mean, that you're not going to pick up everything that's being said here, and I can't either, all right? But I'm just doing this as an illustration. Let's begin in chapter 1, verse 10. It says, "Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In Beth Ophra, roll yourself in the dust. Pass by in naked shame, you inhabitant of Shafir, the inhabitant of Zanan does not go out. Beth Ezel mourns, its place to stand is taken away from you. For the inhabitant of Meroth pined for good, but disaster came down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. O inhabitant of Lachish, harness the chariot to swift steeds. She was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, where the transgressions of Israel were found in you. Therefore, you shall give presents to Moresheth Gath. The houses of Achzib shall be a lie to the kings of Israel. I will yet bring an heir to you, O inhabitants of Mereshah. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Make yourself bald and cut off your hair because of your precious children. Enlarge your baldness like an eagle, for they shall go from you in captivity." So what did I just read? Does everybody fully understand what I just read? I can't exactly understand what they're talking about there, and most of us cannot. But what's happening is this is hard to understand, because what it is being conveyed here is a play on words. Now, I didn't know that. You didn't know that. But all these cities that are being named were important to what Micah was trying to convey. If you look at the Kyle and the Lich commentary on Micah chapter 1 and commenting beginning on verse 9, it talks about all these cities that are mentioned in the prophecy and talking about the fate that awaits them, or rather awaits the kingdom, by a continued play upon words founded upon their names. So Micah was inspired to use the names of these various cities and towns in order to play upon the names of those towns, which the people living in that time would easily understand. But for you and I living now, we don't really understand where most of these places were geographically, and we definitely don't understand the meaning of the different names. And even when I'm going to read it back to you and give you some insight into some of the names, but even then, it's hard to understand what's being said. So But we have to realize to the reader of that day and time, or the listener of that day and time, then what is being said here makes perfect sense. And what's taking place here is it's playing off, basically using these names in order to their word plays. And he's in a sense making puns using these names. For instance, we tell a pun and we laugh because we understand the pun and what it's alluding to, how these word plays work. And we get it, but we can do these word plays among ourselves as English speakers, and people from other countries who've immigrated here, they don't know what we're talking about. We have to explain it to them. Yeah, it goes on here, quoting again from the Kyle and DeLitch commentary. It says, the penetration of the judgment into Judah is now clearly depicted by an individualizing enumeration of a number of cities which will be smitten by it. So this punishment is coming upon the land, and he's using these word plays in order to make a point with them, to try to help them to convey God's message to them, considering Micah chapter 1, verse 10. It says, go not to Gath to declare it. Weeping, weep not. At Beth Leophra, which means dust home, I have strewed dust upon myself. So he goes through all of these puns to make a point with them. And so we can read this, and maybe there will be a day when we'll find all these places and we'll fully understand what was being conveyed. We can get the gist of it because Micah is correcting them and trying to point them in back in God's direction. And he's using these word plays in order to convey that. Even reading this passage to you and giving you the connection on the word play, it's hard for me and all of us, I think, to understand. But at the time when the prophecy was given, it made perfect sense to the people living in that time. So the prophet is telling us, look, this is a message, and for us to dig into it, we have trouble understanding it, and even the best minds that are scholars, they haven't come up with the answer to all of this. So we want to know what they are expressing on God's behalf in their messages, what the audience needs to change in their lives to come into harmony with God, and the consequences if they don't make those changes. And we can get the overall gist of what's being said, even if we don't pick up every aspect of the prophecy. So sometimes we can get involved in reading some of the passages, and it's very hard for us to understand it. And the goal may not be to understand it completely, but we can get the gist of it. So we don't need to get frustrated when we can't understand every aspect of it. Sometimes we can read four or five verses, and at the end of it, we're wondering, what did I just read? And that's not something that's a defect on your part. It's just the fact that we're dealing with something that dates back to 2,500 years and made sense to the people back in that time, but is somewhat hard for us to understand. So let's think about Micah here. And so now I've told you there's no way you can understand it, but you can. So we will look at some verses here and seek to understand what God is conveying. Let's go to Micah chapter 1. Micah chapter 1, and we'll look at, we'll make one simple point here in Micah chapter 1. Micah 1 verse 5, we'll begin there. It says, all this is for the transgression of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the transgression of Jacob? It is not Samaria. Is it not Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? And so what's God saying here? He's saying, I'm not happy with you because of your transgressions. And the warning of God is given, that God is giving in this chapter, the first chapter of Micah, is directed to Israel and Judah for their idolatry. And he's singling out the capital cities because they're the prominent cities in the land, and they are the ones that are these prominent cities, and they're setting the pace for the nation. So you can look at them, and their trend is indicative of the whole nation. So they're basically setting the trend for all of the woeful conditions in the lands of Israel and Judah. Micah 1, verse 6. There it says, "Therefore I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the field, places for planting a vineyard. I will pour down her stones into the valley, and I will uncover her foundations. And all her carved images will be beaten to pieces." So they're involved in idolatry. And he's saying that those who conquer the nation will beat these images that they bow down before in worship. They will beat these images and melt them down. You know, their gold, their silver, they're valuable. They don't believe in them as gods. So they'll just beat them down, break them up, melt them down, and put them into a form that they can easily sell and enhance their bank accounts. In verse 7, it says, and so they're going to take care of these things. They're going to beat all of these things down as they conquer the nation. It goes on to say in verse 7, and all her pay as a harlot. So as you look at their worship, it's a form of harlotry in God's eyes. And it's interesting, as you look at various parts of the world, for instance, in Latin America, we see that they're involved in idolatry, and it goes in various directions. For instance, the Roman Catholic Church in Latin America, as the Catholics took over, they had all of the Indians worshiping a whole variety of gods, a whole variety of idols. Well, what they had to do is they wanted to bring all of these Indian people into the Catholic fold. And so they adopted many of their gods and goddesses. Well, this represents Jesus, this represents Mary, and it became part of Catholicism. And you have, yes, Mary and Jesus and all those icons, but they also had these other gods that were worshipped by the Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayas, the native peoples. And it says all of these idols will be burned with fire, and these idols will lay desolate, for she gathered it from the pay of a harlot, and they shall return to the pay of a harlot. And so as you examine the religion that was taking place in ancient Israel and Judah, sadly, it devolved into false worship, idol worship, and you know, prostitution, fertility rites, and, you know, the most degenerate form, which was human sacrifice. So as you had all of these terrible things going on in the land at that time, and you look at what's taking place here in our country, we don't even worship God in all too many parts of our country, with the God is being abandoned, and we're adopting false gods. Now, there are people that are holding on to biblical values. They're trying to hold on to biblical values. They believe in the family. They believe in the Bible, and they're trying to do that. But you are having a transformation take place in our country, from one end of the country to the other. And even though we're hanging on in some parts of the country where it's more conservative, sadly, this is all encompassing the whole nation. And you're fighting, it seems like a losing battle at this particular point. And I wish it weren't the case, but that's what's going on at this particular time. Let's go to Micah chapter 2 and think about that here for a few minutes. Micah chapter 2. As you look at Micah, about one third of the book of Micah indicts Israel and Judah for their sins. But another third of the book talks about ideals with the future of the future and the hope that God has for Israel. And there's another third of the book that deals with other issues, not just idolatry, but other things that were a problem in Israel. So about a third of the book, as I said, deals with the indictment of Israel and Judah for their idolatry. And since the fulfillment is dual in nature, that means it has different applications and application at that time. And there's also going to be an application at the end of the age. And so there is a warning to them in that time. And there is a warning to all of us living in this time when this is going to play out once again. It's instructional for us to note the reasons why God will send his people into captivity. And he explains that in the book of Micah. But interestingly, the very reasons why Israel and Judah went into captivity are the very reasons why we're going to go into captivity once again. Because we're guilty of the same sins. And those sins are becoming more prevalent. And God said, this is the punishment for those sins. And if we turn to those sinful practices, then the outcome will be the same. So we should not be surprised that our nation is going to eventually go into captivity unless we change our ways. So that's something that we have to keep in mind, that what happened to Israel and Judah can happen to the nations that are descended from Israel unless we change our ways. As you think about, again, what Micah's message was, when God gave the two great commandments, he said, first and foremost, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. That is the first four commandments. We are to honor God. We are to worship no other God but the true God and to honor him in the way that we live. And then the second commandment is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And if you understand what is meant by the second is like unto it, what does that mean? The second is like unto it. And what that's indicating is that the second great commandment is just as important as the first. Yes, you have the first great commandment and the second is like it. And they're both very important to God. You can't keep one and neglect the other. You have to keep them both. So if you have total reverence of God for God, and then you mistreat your fellow man, then you haven't accomplished anything. You've still sinned, you've still fallen short, and you're going to receive the consequences of not loving your fellow man. So as you go through Micah, you don't have any trouble understanding the condemnations for idolatry. And as we look at this, we can also see that the people of Israel and Judah were not treating their fellow Israelites or Jews properly. They were not living by the second great commandment. And Micah begins to spell out in more detail what those sins were. Now let's look at chapter 2, verse 1. Chapter 2, verse 1. So, and this just tells us as we begin verse 1, how bad things were in the land of Israel. It says in Micah 2, verse 1, woe to those who devise iniquity and work out evil on their beds. So Micah's condemning them because they were spending a lot of time thinking about sinful things that they could do to take advantage of their neighbor, to cheat their neighbor, to lie to their neighbor, to take from their neighbor. They were doing this, spending lots and lots of time thinking about these things. It's just like something that I noted when I was doing my stint at Home Depot. It was interesting, the very clever ways that people came up to steal stuff from Home Depot. I mean, they found ways to hide it. ways to disguise it, ways to rip off the company. And I thought, man, they put a lot of time in thinking these things up. I was just amazed at how clever they were. And I guess the thought that went through my mind is, you know, if they were as clever with working as they were with stealing, they would be well ahead in the game. But for some reason, they wanted to take a shortcut, and stealing seemed like a better option to them. So people were devising all of these ways that they could rob and cheat and steal from their neighbors. And it says that, so they think all of these things up. And then the latter half of the verse says, at morning light, they practice it because it is in the power of their hand. I've thought it up, and I know I can bring this off. I know that I can carry out this act of theft and get away with it, or I hope I can. And God was very displeased with them spending their time thinking up all of these schemes to cheat their fellow man. Let's go to verse 4, chapter 2 of Micah, verse 4. It says, they covet fields and take them by violence, also houses, and seize them. And so they're coveting real estate. You know, you have people that have influence with the courts or with judges, and they're able to get the cities or the courts to rule in their favor in order to carry out eminent domain actions because they want a particular property. I mean, the epitome of that type of behavior is in Ahab and Jezebel's time. Ahab wanted his neighbor Naboth's property. He went over and asked him to sell him the property, and Naboth and Ahab said, I'll give you a good price for it. And Naboth said, I can't sell this. This is my heritage. This is what I received from my forefathers that was distributed to me by allotment. I'm not going to sell this. I can't sell it to you. It's part of my family heritage. Well, Ahab just curled up on his bed and was pouting because he didn't get his way. And his wife noticed that he was laying there pouting and said, what's the problem? And he said, well, Naboth won't sell me his vineyard. Well, Jezebel came from a culture where the king and the priest and all of them were all powerful, and whatever they wanted, they could get. And so she said, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. So she killed. She had Naboth killed, falsely accused, killed him. So she thought up this scheme. They carried it out. She got people who would carry it out. And so she got the property and gave it to Ahab. But you're getting away with it, and they did get away with it, and he was happy about it. But God saw what they were doing, and this is the kind of mindset where people figure out ways to cheat other people, to take advantage of other people, and this is just a very common practice in our age. Verse 3 goes on to say, therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, against this family, I am devising disasters. So just as you thought up all of these schemes to take advantage and cheat your neighbor, I am thinking up ways in order to punish you for your inappropriate behavior towards your fellow man. And he said, the disaster is going to come on you from which you cannot remove your necks. And you shall walk, and nor shall you walk haughtily, for this is an evil time. So God said, yes, you're coming up with all of these ideas, these schemes, in order to cheat and rip off your neighbor. But I'm noting this, and you're going to be punished accordingly. You just think about our time. We have Ponzi schemes going on, such as Bernie Madoff cheating people out of their inheritance, out of their retirement, and it's supposedly investing it, and that he wasn't doing that at all. He was taking money from one and passing it along to others as profits while he and his family pocketed it. Just think of the scam that's been run by the fellow with all of the the fellow with the big hair that had, they were having all of the, what's it called? I can't think of it, where they, you know, he had the, I'll have to go on from it, but anyway, he was cheating people, and then the whole scheme collapsed, and people lost lots of money. You have, you know, you're having banks, they're being fined for sharp practices. You have, for instance, you probably get some notices about you need to pay an invoice. You get people that claim that your bank account or payments are in arrears, or you get all of, we're getting them. In fact, somebody stole my credit card information when we were traveling a couple of weeks ago, and we've had problems. And once you start having problems, you've got to go through a lot of work to repair the damage. And these things are all common, and you have to be very wary of them. And God is condemning such immorality. And Micah is telling them that on God's behalf, they need to change their ways. Micah chapter 2, verse 8 says, "Lately, my people have risen up as an enemy. You pull off the robe with the garment from those who trust you as they pass by like men returned from war." And so what does that mean? It sounds a little confusing, but you know, as you analyze what's said there, it means a man returns from war, you know, where his life's been on the line, on the battlefield, and he comes into his homeland and he takes a breath and he says, "I'm safe. I'm back home and I'm safe." And sadly, he's not safe. He thinks he is, but the society has become so corrupted that, you know, he's a target, and people can easily take advantage of it. You look at people that live in neighborhoods, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous just to go to the store. And you're seeing the results of a lack of policing and a lack of prosecution in places like San Francisco. You have stores that are pretty famous and pretty prominent, and they're pulling out of San Francisco because of all of the theft that's coming about with the stores. People go in there. You have all of these mob actions and things. And it's just, you know, when you hear the statement that Christ made about lawless times, we live in them. You go on to verse 9. It says, "The women of my people you cast out from their pleasant houses. From their children, you take away my glory forever." So basically, you are taking the breadwinner, the man of the family, which was most important in that time. And once he died or was taken out of the household, then the wife and the children were all vulnerable because they had no defense. They had no standing in the They had no standing in the society, and they were very vulnerable. So this is something dangerous that was happening in the time, and God was making note of it and said it was inappropriate. Now, just a few comments here as we come to this, the end of the Bible study. First of all, as you think about the book of Micah as an example, how do most people see the book of Micah? Most people see the book as history, and it's something that took place back 2,500 years ago and has no application to the present. It's just ain't something ancient. It's something interesting, something that's historical, but it has no future or current application. That's how many people see it. This isn't our understanding. We believe that there are references to the future playing out, and it also has much application to our lives today. And if we would heed it, then we would be blessed as a result. As you look at this also, the Book of Micah not only talks about the past and has an application to the present, but it also talks about the future. So it talks about what is to be, something that isn't here yet, but is going to come. And a lot of people don't see it this way. They see it as all past. There is nothing to come. There is nothing future about it at all. However, I would not agree with that. And what we're going to look at as the final thing to consider tonight in the study, let's go to Micah chapter 2 and begin in verse 12. Micah chapter 2, verse 12. So we have information in Micah about the past, the way things were in ancient Israel and Judah. And from what God said to ancient Israel and Judah, we can learn and we can apply the principles found there in our everyday lives. And finally, we can look at Micah and realize that there are wonderful prophecies of the future, what you would call a millennial references. And so let's look at a few verses here that talk about the future. Micah chapter 2, verse 12. Micah chapter 2, verse 12. There it says, I will surely assemble all of you, O Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep of the fold, like a flock in the midst of their pasture. They shall make a loud noise because of so many people. Now, as you think about that, when have the people of Israel and Judah been gathered together as one? And they were such a massive throng, like a great flock in the midst of a pasture. When has that happened? I would say that it hasn't happened. It's something that is yet to come. Verse 13 says, the one who breaks open will come up from before them. They will break out, pass through the gate and go out by it. Their king will pass before them with the Lord at their head. Now, when has it been that we've had all of these people in a sense break out like a flock into the field? They break out with God at their head. We saw that when Israel came out of Egypt. We saw that as Israel led Egypt through the wilderness to the land of promise. But we've not seen this happen at all since then. Since Israel fell and Judah fell, we have not seen anything like this. This is a passage you can use that points what will happen in the millennial kingdom. That's our vantage point. Not everybody agrees with that, but we can look at that and it provides great encouragement to us that the God's plan is going to work out. And even if Israel in ancient times fell, it's still going to work out for them in the future. And even if we fall today and go into captivity, then it's still going to work out. There's going to come a time when God is going to begin to work with them, either in the millennial kingdom, when he'll bring them back from captivity and into the land of promise, or God will resurrect them. We know there is a second resurrection that's talked about in the eighth day. And God can raise them up, and he will raise them up. And he will bring these people back and give them the opportunity for salvation. So God offers mankind wonderful things, and his plan is going to work out. And yes, you do have the correction in the book of Micah and in the other prophets. And God's purpose in giving those prophecies is to get the people to turn back to him and to begin following the right path. He has no desire to punish them if they will turn around, if they will repent and begin to walk in his ways. So we end here with a positive note from the book of Micah. And this will conclude our Bible study for this evening, and we'll pick up and continue the examination of the prophet Micah in our next study, which we'll pick up in the month of July. So thanks, everybody, for your attention. Hopefully you've found it profitable, and we'll be able to take to heart some of the things that we find in the book of Micah. And, you know, if you have the time to go read through the book, then it's well worth your time to do so. So I appreciate everybody's participation. Hopefully you found it profitable.